Welcome to PageCast, a podcast series brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers, aimed to give you the story behind the story. By interviewing the authors responsible for some of your most loved books, we explore the thoughts, ideas, emotions, and creative processes that led to the writing of these books. If you're a reader with a zesty interest in people and stories, do stick around and enjoy what PageCast has to offer.
Give Us More Guns, How South Africa's Gangs Were Armed by Mike Shaw. It was one of the most brutal criminal acts of the post-apartheid era, and its consequences devastating. Thousands of people, including women and children, died between 2011 and 2019 as a result of one senior police officer's crime: his decision to sell millions of rands worth of guns to fund his children's university fees. Colonel Christian Prinsloo, the former head of the Gauteng Firearm License Division, and a network of his cronies sold thousands of guns that had been decommissioned by SAPS to South Africa's gang lords. The sale of those lethal weapons, which the police service tried to cover up, led to a killing spree of unprecedented proportions. Cape Town, which became the destination for most of these guns, is now one of the most violent places on earth. Based on hundreds of interviews with police and the criminal underworld, Give Us More Guns tells the story of this callous crime for the first time. In this book, Mark Shaw explores how the illegally sold guns got into the hands of South Africa's crime bosses. In this episode, Mark Shaw will be in conversation with Mandy Wiener, one of South Africa's best known and most credible journalists and authors.
So we were joking before the start of this event that Mark is wearing a white shirt, and every time I've seen him, he wears white shirts. And Jennifer said that it's because the saying goes that in court you should always wear a white shirt. So it adds to, you know, that element of the dignified, I said facade, but I need to take that back, right?
Yeah, well, maybe not.
Okay, so we're going to start off, and I think that this book is really about one particular crime, and as you describe on the cover of the book, in the blurb, it really is, you know, perhaps one of the most brutal criminal acts of the post-apartheid era. Its consequences are devastating. And at the center of it all is this police colonel, Christian Prinsloo, who decided to sell millions of rands worth of guns that belonged to the police to fund his children's university fees. And you estimate that around 9,000 guns were sold onto the streets, around 1,000 murders were actually carried out with these guns. But before we delve into the actual crime, I want to start by zooming out and placing it all in context. And a lot has been written and spoken about the Cape Ganglands, the history, the politics, but let's place this crime in context. So set the scene for us before the guns flooded the Cape Flats. What was happening?
Mandy, as you know, the Cape Flats have, for a variety of historical reasons, going back to forced removals and the like, have had a set of gangs or nascent gangs, and they've evolved over the years, firstly with the influx of mandrax in the 80s and the 90s, and then other forms of drugs, South Africa joining the global illicit economy, becoming more integrated into the expanding global illicit economy, and the numbers of people recruited into gangs has grown over this period, and the book contains, as you know, an overview of membership of gangs. And I think it's really important to understand that gangs and individuals who may belong or be associated are kind of a spectrum of people. So sort of youth gangs, and then hardcore gangsters, and then really what you might call crime bosses, if you like. So before this period, in the beginning in the 1990s, there were a range of pagad attacks. The gangs were to some degree at one point on the back foot. A resurgence, higher levels of violence. Gangs had access to guns, there's no question, historically, and certainly after 1994, but not in enormous numbers. And gang members have said consistently that, you know, the gang boss would hold a cache of guns, which he would loan out to individual gang members. But then a flood of guns arrived from around 2007. And that, everybody says, began to transform the nature of gangsterism, given the sort of the economy of gangs, the need for territory, and a range. So a sort of perfect storm, if you liked, of which guns was a absolutely key component. And these were not only, but a significant number were state guns.
Mm. So you spend some time in the book just laying out the kind of landscape, the patchwork that is being protected by the different gangs. And, you know, we hear the names, but here you kind of dissect it and lay it all out. And you tell us about the Americans and the hard livings, but then you tell us about the junky, funky kids and the nice time kids and the fancy boys and the Dixie boys and the junior mafias and, you know, all of the terrible justers and all the names come out. How important is it for us to understand the kind of workings of that gangland world so that we understand who gets the guns and where the guns are fed through to?
I think what the book, you're right, I wanted to lay out what the flows of the gangs were, because actually I was trying to trace where the first guns arrived, you know, who made the first purchase, who made the first contact, and the book outlines some of that. And then I wanted to trace the stream of the guns, and it was actually quite hard to do for a variety of reasons. A couple of points which I think your question is getting to is there are a number of, well, at the risk of simplifying it, but two larger constellations of gangs, the 26s and the 28s, a particularly big gang, the Americans, which is very devolved in its organization, as elsewhere, where, as you know, I'm working internationally, and as elsewhere, I think this is in fact part of the consolidation of the gangs over time. However, and most of the gang wars, as I've outlined, it take place between the Americans and other gangs, and there's several examples of that. But I think it's important to understand in my view, because the information was that the first guns were going onto the side of the 28s, and it was extremely important for the Americans, the consolation on the other side, to access guns to bring a degree of balance into the sort of gangland. And I guess a couple of interesting points. Firstly, some gangs are unaligned to both sides, so they were bridges through which guns flowed. Some gangs didn't have cash available to buy guns, which was actually of a lot of interest. I would have thought, well, gangs would automatically have cash available, but they returned with cash. So there was this process of bargaining around accessing different consignments of guns. With different gangs, you know, the 28s wanting the Z88, which is a gun that sort of features prominently in the book because it's a sort of decommissioned police gun. So the story is the intertwining of all of these elements. And Prince Lo himself didn't want to get close to the gangs, understandably so. So he had an intermediary who's still to stand trial, who was doing the negotiations. And the gangs bought the guns in bulk, and in my view, quite cheaply. And you can understand why that's the case, in the sense the negotiations were uneven. And once gang bosses knew there were guns available and they knew the source, they didn't hesitate to approach it and approach it in a threatening way. So these initial transactions, which began to, you know, where the seller had a degree of, if you like, bargaining power, I think quickly evened out over time, and guns were then flowing 2007, to 2013-14. So that's a number of years.
So gangs operate in a similar way all over the world. They evolve out of a particular political economy, and that usually involves breaking up of communities, as you say. And you write this line in the book A gang needs turf to sell drugs and needs guns to control its turf. It's as simple as that. And that's why they needed the guns.
Yes, and that's what gang bosses and others say quite directly, that, you know, the economy is you need to own territory, and you own it in a number of ways. Of course, you know, this is very characteristic elsewhere, the painting of symbols, the you know, which street you own, which particular neighborhood. And if the opposition gets guns, or if you get guns, you get additional power and you can expand that territory. And that territory relates to where you can sell, where you can practice extortion. Extortion is important. Extortion in a variety of forms is an important part of that arrangement. So the sort of triangle drugs, territory, recruitment. So recruitment of people is part of this, and then guns.
And then you also need a spider in the web, such as the lawyer, Nuruddin Hassan. And you need rampant corruption within the police and in the gun licensing system. And all of these are the ingredients for this perfect storm, which we saw happening.
Yes, and I really do think it was a kind of perfect storm. This integration of South Africa into the global drug economy in a much bigger way than it had been before. You know, information that South African crime bosses were reaching out to other contacts overseas, the growth of the heroin economy in Cape Town and elsewhere. And in while we talk about the Cape Flats gangs, that the core gang bosses having a national reach, being regular visitors to Johannesburg, to Durban, you know, the connections between Durban and Cape Town are very important. And the point about the guns, I think they were also a useful recruitment tool, because young guns are power and status, and young men wanted to join because those were available. And the seizures of guns increased because young gangsters threw away their guns, the police report. There were just a lot available. So I think, you know, I was outside the country and then coming to UCT a couple of years, you know, just as in the year or two before the case was breaking. And, you know, the violence was surging up, and these endless series of gang wars, which culminate in the military being deployed in 2019. So that's a very significant event. You know, the police can no longer control what is essentially free for all shooting matches in some cases. So you know, one of my responses, and it's clear in the book, I hope, is people always say, well, this is quite stereotypical. You know, this is characteristic of the Cape Flats. Actually, this is much more complicated than that. This, of course, is a historical evolution, but a particular form of organized crime has been driven by both the internal and external factors, and the guns have been a key part of that.
Because as you say, the gangs had always had access to guns that were stolen during burglaries or other ad hoc crimes, but they were hard to come by and they were considered to be very precious. But suddenly the Cape Flats was awash with firearms, and all these guns, as you say, came from three major sources. The Z88 or the Zulus used by the cops, there were the guns handed in by unsuspecting citizens, and then guns from the SAPS armory. So what happened? What was the process? I mean, I don't want to give away too much of what's in the book, but all of a sudden, the Cape Flats is awash with guns.
I mean, the first point to make is, and the book shows some evidence of that with the police's own statistics, is that there was already a market for police guns before 2007, 2008. So if you look at the statistics, around 10,000, so these are not the Prinsloo guns, as the book makes clear, around 10,000 police guns go missing or lost. Now, I'm not saying all of those ended up into the underworld, but in a variety of ways, guns are seeping out of the police, and it's some stations are much worse than others. So some stations have no loss, others have actually substantial loss. So the sense actually that there's a gun economy developing, and what gang folks said is, well, of course they knew they could buy guns from the police. The police were a legitimate source because, you know, you go to where the source of guns is. And so this economy was developing, and I suspect Prince Lua knew that. I was told, you know, that he tested the market with some Z88. These three sources that you outlined, Mandy, so the decommissioned around the Z88 made in the late 1980s, it's issued out, it's a copy of the Beretta. So in the early 2000s, there's a large number of them are taken back. So they are centralized in another part of the perfect storm. They are centralized in the police armory, source number one. Source number two, what citizens have handed in the amnesties from 94, etc. And source number three, guns from the SAPS 13 store. So guns that are seized, guns that have been used in evidence. And they are centralized for destruction. In Vereeniging, which is the old steel center or steel manufacturing center, and they are melted down. Prince Lua and a colleague, also a colonel called David Naidu, extracts some of these guns, and there are two lines to this. Extract some of these and sell them in bulk, but there's also an active collector's market for guns from the Boer War, guns that have been used in what was then the Rhodesian Bush War, whatever else, and these are collector's items. And if they're handed in, Prince Lua is an expert. And with another gun collector who he knows in Vereeniging, he is extracting those guns as well. So there are two lines to this, to the crime. And while guns are being destroyed, you know, the minister may come and it's a celebration, and the guns are crushed and whatever. Other guns are extracted and transported primarily to Cape Town, although there's some evidence, as the book explains, that it also goes to Durban. And that's essentially the cynical crime. And at the same time, you can find in the press, Prince Lua quoted asking people to hand in their guns in amnesties and giving information. And also this weird, and that in a sense, this dichotomy, if you like, between, you know, we need to hand in guns in amnesties, how many we've handed in, police citizens hand in your guns, at the same time that guns were being sold out the back door. And that's, to me, makes it just this almost unbelievable crime. Here's the police meant to seize the guns. You know, and that's why in the book, as you know, I say these are our guns. In a sense, they belong to us as citizens. You know, the Z88s were paid by citizens, taxpayers. This is a system that, you know, pulled the guns in, and yet they leaked out in bulk. And the system to do that failed, you know. Yes, Prince Lua, Naidu are bad apples, so to speak, but the sort of the overall systems of control and security just didn't work. And it wasn't a once-off crime, and it took place over a number of years and many consignments.
And this is the mad irony for me, and why I find this so astonishing, because I mean, I vividly recall as a reporter in the newsroom at the time, a number of my colleagues going to these big events where these guns were destroyed and melted down and exploded and all of that. And as you say, the very people that were asking people to hand in their guns were the ones selling them off to the ganglands. And you tell some pretty riveting stories in the book about these various middlemen and how they got these these caches of guns down to Cape Town. I think his name is Petros, you called him. This guy who takes a tog bag full of guns and hides it in full sight on a bus that he takes. I mean, this is the sheer brazenness of some of these stories I found unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And it's kind of and I'm using a phrase which a gang interview user, it was sort of like flies to a honeypot. I mean, hence the title, Give Us More Guns. Once it was clear that there was a line, there's a line of guns coming from the police. The police are giving us guns, people said. You know, and then amongst that, and you can understand why communities on the Cape Flats, at least, the sense that there was a conspiracy that, you know, the police are supplying and feeding gang violence. And Prince Lua had a story, I don't want to say the source of it, but that he was, you know, that he had actually sold the guns for piracy protection of Somalia. And you know, I personally, having worked there for the UN on these issues, I thought, well, let me, you know, see if there's any grounds to this. And I think it's absolutely groundless story. But the reason, of course, that he was saying that in the sense that guns could be used to protect ships passing through the piracy zone and then thrown overboard and would effectively disappear. You know, he said in court papers, you know, when he essentially turned state witness, that it's 2,400 guns. I have to say, I don't believe that, as the book says. And, you know, a constellation of interviews around him and what gangsters themselves say, I think the number is considerably higher.
So tell us about this Colonel Chris Prinsler, this frustrated cop who was looked over for promotion. What made him go from the most highly regarded expert on guns in the steps to somebody who was essentially arming the gangs? You look at his pathology in the book, but, you know, break that down for us.
I mean, it's hard to know why anyone would commit a crime like this, in my view. And I thought a lot about it. You know, was he a racist? Was he, you know, was there political motive for this? And I think the answer is none of that. It's this almost classic case. He was frustrated. He had a very high opinion of himself. He was always, and this phrase is used by multiple people in describing him, he was the cleverest person in the room. And you know, when you were talking about guns, and guns are really an expert community, so there's lots of detail and stuff to know, and he knew it. You know, he could identify different types, et cetera, et cetera. So he was the cleverest person in the room. He had a very high regard for his expertise, as did others. And he had an arrogance about him in that expertise. Secondly, he in a way thought he was cleverer than others. And in fact, this crime, he thought it was, in a sense that he got away with it for so long, sort of comes through the, and he needed money. I think he made less money than it appears. That's my point, because I feel they were underselling the number of guns, and there's some calculations around the money in the book. But at the same time, there's this weird contradiction that he's a loyal police officer. So when the police arrest him, he almost knew he was going to be arrested. He turns and immediately starts to help them even before a lawyer arrives. You know, well, of course, these are, you know, I need to help my fellow police officers. So it's this strange contradiction. But he had been passed over for promotion, and there appears to be a racial element in that. You know, he was a colonel, and somebody was appointed to a brigadier post who was black, and by all accounts that led to a sense of frustration. So you can sense all of these things a little bit, like, you know, like, well, these guns are going to be destroyed anyway. Firstly, secondly, well, it's just going to criminals, you know. I don't think he put a value on. I don't know if he made a. If he did, it was very cynical. And thirdly, well, the system owes me, and so I'll extract from the system in any event. Now, this package is not uncommon, I think, in relation to, you know, corrupt practices. Well, I've been passed over for promotion. Well, this is just my due. Actually, I'm quite smart anyway. So, you know, it's this, and that's the book tries to sketch out that constellation of psychological activities, if you like, Mandy.
So Prinsler gets sentenced to 20 years in jail in 2016, and then he unexpectedly, 2018, unexpectedly gets released on parole in 2020, because he is now, it seems, going to be a state witness. It just sounds crazy. I mean, that's insane that he only served a couple of years for this crime.
Yes, I mean, there hasn't been much of an outcry. There was Avusi Pikoli, for example, tweeted, and there was some outrage around it. I mean, the truth is that he is in witness protection because his life is under serious threat, because he has to give evidence against others in this case. And he owes it to us, is at least how I would like to say it. So, yes, it's a very short sentence. It brings up, of course, the old debate, which you yourself know from previous books about, you know, when you know turning state witness, etc. And once the chain begins to unfold. David Naidoo's even more interesting case. He doesn't appear to serve any a prison sentence. He seems to have been part of the discussion. He will also provide evidence in the cases that are coming. So the alleged intermediary Lahia is the key target, at least of the state, and the individual Alan Raves, who's allegedly involved on the heritage firearm side, the sort of more that I referred to earlier, they're standing trial together. Whether or not the key gangsters are next in line, I the book makes a point more that the target of some of those key folk is around the firearms licensing and corruption process. So, you know, I guess one last point to make, Mandy, is that for me, this is this huge crime, and it's been quite difficult to follow. Certainly, if you're an ordinary citizen, there's a couple of news stories, etc., taking place over time. So the purpose was really to try and piece all of that together, link it to the country's homicide rate, the sort of failing system of gun control, the damaged systems within the police, to tell this bigger story through what at least I regard to be the most deadly crime of post-apartheid South Africa.
I do wonder often why some stories create, you know, a furor and others don't, where people will get worked up, the public will get worked up about certain things, and yet here you've got one of the most heinous crimes of the post-apartheid era, and yet there doesn't seem to be any outrage about it. And I also, unfortunately, you know, many people have got this theory that the Cape gangs are not sexy enough as a story, as a news story. Yeah. And that's why they don't get covered as much in the news, or people don't necessarily read as many books about them. Do you agree with that, or do you think that's a very cynical view?
I disagree entirely. I mean, a couple of points. I don't think it has taken the public imagination, because it occurred over a long time, and Prince was like an indirect, you know, he wasn't shooting anybody directly. He was supplying the mm-hmm. tools to others. I think that's a very cynical view, frankly. There's no doubt that these guns had just a massive impact. I think the gang issue on Cape Town, firstly, we should call it for what it is in many cases. It's a hardcore organized crime. And it has developed like that, at least at its top level, and we need a way to respond to it much more effectively. And in the you know, people, because they live often in excluded communities on the Cape Flats and elsewhere, people live in extraordinarily violent communities where there are shootouts regularly, where you know, parents fear for taking their children you know, out of the house, etc., where schools are, where gangs are active in schools, etc. And in the crossfire of the guns delivered into this morass of violence are a lot of children, very young children, and the reports, you know, in a way we are almost so immunized to these reports. You know, four-year-old, I saw one the other day, you know, lost their eye. There was, I saw data from the Red Cross Children's Hospital, the quite dramatic increase in gunshot wounds and of children. This is a feature of putting into a very contested violent space firearms, and those firearms are used, and in a sense we're reaping the whirlwind. And you can simply tell that by Cape Town's homicide rate, and I make this point in the book, you know, anything above 30 per 100,000 is high, but there are parts of Cape Town, you know, 70-100 cases per 100,000, so sort of warlike conditions.
And that's the real effect of Prinsloo's crime here, is that it has ended in bloodshed in so many murders. I do want to take you to the actual process of deciding to write this book and researching it and why you chose this particular story, although it's quite clear. You're a researcher, not a journalist, but your books read as if they're written by a journalist. Do you find people more inclined to speak to you because you are a researcher? And are there times where you feel like you are kind of straying into that realm of being a journalist?
I think let's call it the information economy, for whatever, for want of a better word, is changing. And I think these kinds of activities occur along a spectrum. You know, journalism is so crucial, and crime reporters, you know, like a absolutely crucial component to being able to write a book like this, because you're picking up individual stories of lots of individual reports of both incidents or seizures or contacts with the police, etc. And that's crucial. The role of research at the Global Initiative, but just generally, the role of research is to paint a bigger picture and point towards policy solutions. And the role of research is to tell, it's not a is to contextualize individual incidents in a bigger contextual space. But you want people to read your research. And you know, I have had some interesting discussions with Jeremy Berain at Jonathan Ball, because if you wrote a dry overview of guns, you know, it may be excellent, but no one would read it. And so I feel that this is a better book than Hitmen. Hitmen for me was very important, similar kind of book to say, well, hits are suddenly all over the place in South Africa. What's the economy of these hits? Can we tell the stories of the individuals involved? This is a similar book, but I feel that I'm learning how to do it better, to translate the multiple interviews into a series of narratives about people. And people want to read about people, and policies about people, and the harm caused by guns is about people. And so this is a very people-centric book. And so it should be in my view. And I spent quite a lot of time, you know, redrafting it and cutting a lot of the policy stuff out, because the point was to tell a story, and through telling that story, highlight a key issue, which is that the state leaks guns and vast quantities of guns, and we are paying the price as a country for that.
So you do all of these interviews, and you speak to all these people, you recount your meetings with gangsters in safe houses and at the Rhodes Memorial tea room, which sadly we've now lost. I was pretty terrified at times. You know, I think that you like seriously ballsy, you know, some of these encounters that you have with these gangsters. You know, was that a concern for you? How easy was it for you to go into Menenberg and meet with a gangster and hear their story? You know, you needed all of that color, and you bring the story to life, that academia to life that way. But what was your experience of doing that?
I mean, from a research perspective, I have done this for a long time. And of course, if you are working in the field of criminology, not to speak to people who are involved or linked to crime just seems to me, at least, not an option. I think you are right that it is easier as a researcher to access interviews, partly because there's not a story to break next day, and partly because, for a variety of reasons, journalists don't always go to underworld sources, and they don't go lower down into gangs or underworld organizations, understandably. So a journalist wouldn't necessarily talk to a mid-level gangster, in my opinion. You can tell me whether there's a deadline. So you talk to the police, you might talk to the gang boss, you might talk to others who are involved, but you're unlikely to talk to the guy I'm interested in who's put the bag of guns on the bus from Johannesburg to Cape Town. For me, he's a key part of the research story of piecing together what happened and the color of how that happened. I'm also interested in speaking to, I think that applies to journalists too, lower level police people who have different reflections or experiences and communities, which journalists do speak to. That's absolutely true. None of this means I'm critical of journalism in any way, Mandy. But my point is to try and draw a distinction between a process of qualitative research, which is to do as many interviews as you can while putting people at ease to get them to talk. And in some ways, anonymity becomes important because you, and in a way, there's also a trusting relationship between a research author presenting a package of data, which is contextualized with qualitative interviews, in the context of a narration that tells a story. And I mean, I'm very, of course, and surprisingly very interested in nonfiction and how to try and do it. And I'm only an amateur. I want to do it better and better. But I think that's the process. And there's if you look at like a spate of American criminal justice style books written by academics, or you could call them quasi-academics, think tank types, many people are attempting to do this, the story of cases with a policy objective, but to tell a narrative. And I at least think that that's something worth trying to do. People read policy papers and the like, but that's a very small audience. So how can you reach a bigger audience and have a sense of public outrage around, outrage is perhaps the wrong word, but a sense of public understanding about what's happened and that we can do something about it, I think is the point of a book like this.
As you say, exactly that ultimately it is about policy change, and you make some recommendations in the book around the circulation of illegal firearms, the National Firearms Registry, and that we need a cleanup altogether. Yeah. So what are you hoping to achieve here? What would you like to see happen?
I mean, the first point to make is that I have historically been very interested in the reduction of homicide rates and the reduction of homicide. And given South Africa's extraordinarily high levels of murder and the somewhat contested debates around it, including, you know, the endless release of the crime statistics and the interpretations that are provided around social violence, etc., some of which are true, some of which I think are massaged for the benefit of the state, etc. I think the challenge with safety policy, in my view, is that we try and do too much. And, you know, this was always my criticism of the National Crime Prevention Strategy, in a sense, which is this great attempt, actually, which worked, you know, in its early days because homicide reduced. But the challenge of policy is to focus on a small number of things. And I think guns is provides that. It provides a very, very focused thing to focus on. And guns in the underworld are precisely that. And if the state is a key source of weaponry, then we have systems, and we know that we have systems in which we can stop that. And if we can stop that, we can reduce the homicide rate. And the reality is we were doing that because, you know, the new firearms legislation came into effect in 2004, 2005. There's you know, this small literature. Okay, it's a very small number of people looking at this, but one of the questions was, where have all the firearms gone? You know, I forget the exact date of the article, sort of mid-2000s. And the homicide rate was on the slow decline until 2011, 2012. And yes, these are statistics, you know, of interest to a small number of people debating it. But those statistics have enormous human costs, obviously, it's people being killed and driving fear, etc. And if you look at the combination of the upswing of homicide and you combine it with mortuary data, particularly in Cape Town, you can see the impact of firearms as the homicide rate starts to track up to over 60 per 100,000. So the point is to say we need a serious look at all of these issues. That means an independent audit of gun destruction. And one of the key issues here is that the in a sense, the police have become much less accountable. And that's the point that the book tries to make. The police have never acknowledged really that they are the source of a significant quantity of firearms. How can that be? The police are here to serve the community rather than be the very source of weapons. Mm. So for me, that's, you know, just in the context of policing and democracy, that's a fundamental point. So independent order to build trust in these processes. Secondly, I think the firearms registry, as the book spells out, has serious challenges, consistently serious challenges. I asked through a Freedom of Information request for some documentation. I never got it. I had other documentation, and it's just consistently problems of corruption. And what I was interested in is gang bosses applying for and receiving large numbers of firearms. And so the system is in a way broken. And that's a system that can be fixed. And I would argue to establish a separate process, potentially civilian run outside of the SAPS. So, you know, all of these systems are creaking or not functioning. And we are paying the price. And the Prinsloo case stands at the center of that. But the Prinsloo case is linked to the killing of Kinnear, is linked to the issuing of licenses. These are reported separately, they're a continuum of failure and enormously harmful impact for us as a country.
So I do want to pick up on this issue of the police and corruption and where we are at the moment with the infighting and factionalism in crime intelligence and in the Western Cape. I just want to remind everyone that they can ask questions. So you're welcome to post questions in the comments, and we will pick those up, and we're monitoring those. So if you have questions for Mark, please post them, and we'll put them through to Mark. So as you were saying, you know, there is this issue currently that it is related to Charles Kinnear as well and what's happening there. And yet in the book, although it very much is about corrupt cops, there are also the good cops. So there is the character, for example, of Extien, who's the first police officer to pick up the fact that the guns are coming in. And then you've got this very complex character of Jeremy Veery, who features there, and then Peter Jacobs, who we know was the head of crime intelligence until just a couple of weeks ago. But you've got all of these characters who are also complex police officers.
Yeah.
And that also affects our view of whether the police are just corrupt. You know, some people are very cynical about this and say, well, the cops are just corrupt. But there are good police officers here as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. As you know, it's very disconcerting to try understand the extraordinary, you know, this factionalized policing structure in the Western Cape in particular. And as you know, I've tried to describe it as best I can and the linkages and the complexities of it. But this has to, and the characters, good and bad and kind of gray in the middle, this just has to impact upon the nature of the policing that is able to be provided. And the story of Extien, this constable that finds it, who himself is quite an interesting character, as the book outlines. But these guys don't go up the system. This, for me, is the most symbolic thing of all. They stumble on this emerging case of police weapons, essentially, with gangsters and information. They don't report it up the hierarchy because they feel it will be compromised. I mean, what greater symbolic act than that? And they go outside of the system to try and piece it together. They go secretly to the National Commissioner, Pieche at the time. So this is, you know, quite a long time ago. So and of course, like many bureaucracies, what's on paper doesn't necessarily, you know, the networks and the phone calls and the messages that are made. And I've tried to sort of give a sense of that. But, you know, man, you're also doing interviews in the Western Cape. You sort of a level of paranoia sets in after a while, as you know, because you don't know who to trust or how. And I tried to convey that also in the book, and the rumors about individuals and you know, who's involved in what and the sort of misinformation that is thrown into the system, which you sort of have to clear through and check, and that continues. And I think that says a lot about how damaged the overall system of policing is. Not only the, you know, the processes and the systems, firearms registry, but the nature of the management. Lots of generals, but very poor systems of management, very poor control of around firearms. You know, incredibly courageous cops, Kinnear, investigating away, but not knowing who to trust. The sort of integration between serious hardcore criminality and people in the police. So it's for me very complicated to understand. But the truth is that the system is dramatically weakened and not working. And an indictment, despite the bravery of the police officers involved, is that it took a very long time to find out that police weapons were, you know, the police ran sources in all gangs. It was, I don't want to say widely known, but a lot of people knew there were police weapons, you know, swirling around in relatively large numbers. So you have a sense, and I guess that's also the point of the book. You have a sense that, and I've said this before, that the response to crime is just reactive. We pick up bodies and we investigate cases, not always very successfully, but we don't have a proactive strategy to target key people and issues, firearms from the state being one, in which we can turn this around. And unless we can move from that reactive, not losing core elements of the reactive, which are key, to the preventative, focused on a core number of things, we won't be able to make a difference. And that's the message that I want to make from the book. And in a sense, the police have become more authoritarian, less accountable. You know, you could almost say, ironically, there was this golden age of policing, 94, the sense of transition and new ideas. We've lost that. And in a way, if we want to reduce crime, we have to return to some of those kinds of approaches.
The problem you've also got is that if you look at somebody like Charles Kinnear, who was closing in on these guns for gangs investigations, and then he was assassinated. Yeah. And much of the reporting seems to suggest it was as a result of this investigation, which sends a pretty strong message to the police as well to not scratch too close to that itch.
I mean, as you know, from and having looked at a lot of hits myself for the previous book, and as you know, we continue to monitor individual cases, hits are entirely, of course, they are about eliminating an individual, but they are very symbolic. They send messages, which is why hit lists are such a powerful tool to circulate, because you don't have to kill everybody on a hit list. You simply need to... You need to send the message that you have the power to do that. I hope that the Kinnear case, because it is a senior police officer, and there was another police colonel, Brewer, in working on wildlife trafficking, which has got much, much less coverage.
I reported on that when it happened as well. Exactly. That was also a clear assassination of a police officer who was getting too close to the source. Totally.
Yeah, exactly. And that sends an important message. You know, if you remember the degree to which a mafia prosecutor in Italy, Falcone, was killed along with a partner of his, and that transformed the Italian response to organized crime. You know, if you can hope that the kind of Kinnear killing transforms the response to organized crime in the context of South Africa, it really does mean prosecuting that case successfully, following it up with the media, getting to the core set of people behind it. And you had a feeling of that in the early days. There really was an outcry. Kinnear's wife has remained an enormously courageous figure, speaking out and drawing attention to the issues involved. So in a way, I think we're at a crucial point on a number of cases, not only the Prinsloo case, but, you know, the case of Kinnear, the case of two high profile gang underworld style figures who are charged around the firearms corruption. So there's a set of cases coming together, which I think will hopefully have an important impact. But the system is permeated by corruption, and all the more reason to shine a light on it, to report on it, to monitor these cases more effectively. Hence the huge critical role of crime reporters operating in very difficult environments, but also of the research community looking for sort of the key turning points, the key events in a sort of unfolding discussion around making South Africa safer.
Mark, I have a question for you off the Twitter. A question from Mark Shaw. We know plus minus how many rounds and weapons go missing per month from SAPS. What about from the SANDF?
It's a very good question. They are not consolidated figures from the SANDF. There are lots of individual reports. The most recent, most prominent was in December 2019. I think it was 19 R5s, which were picked up as missing in an audit in Pretoria. So you get quite a lot of, you can get the data from parliamentary questions, etc. The biggest military loss of firearms is around 500, I think in 2017, in an army base in the Eastern Cape. So military bases have been targeted. The Simonstown Naval Base was targeted. Those firearms were retrieved. So there's no doubt that the military is a target. But in response to the question, there isn't a consolidated set of figures as the police have been releasing. I don't have any doubt that there has been leakage from the military, and you can see this in the sort of scattering of reports. And you can see this also if you watch media coverage of cash in transit and other crimes. Mm. When the gun is named, or look at the picture of the gun on the scene, R4s, R5s, LM4s, LM5s. So call it the civilian semi-automatic version, which is held by private security companies. I think private security companies probably leak too. I have heard lots of stories. I have heard stories of firearms leaking from armories over our border, Zimbabwe, Namibia. So I wouldn't only restrict it to the South African military. But so the sense that firearms disappear from armories is, of course, common globally, you know, from Libya, whatever. But we have enough control and capacity to maintain control over the armories, and it should be absolute priority. Sorry, Mandy, can I add just to the question? If you look at the numbers and the reports of firearms from metros, Kulaleni, we asked some freedom of information requests. We didn't get answers, but you can see it. You know, from guns, gangsters have shown, you know, they are metro guns. So they may have been stolen from officers, but it's also possible that they leaked. And when you see the figures, their guns have gone missing. Mm. Peristatals. So there are a variety of sources within the broader state where guns can leak into the underworld.
Well, Mark, I've loved chatting to you. I think this book is an excellent piece of research, and it's so necessary to shine a light on this case that needs much more attention. I think you have shown remarkable courage and insight, and you take us into the darkest corners of the ganglands. So highly recommended.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me. I appreciate it a lot. Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of PageCast. We have an incredible lineup of author interviews, so head over to our Facebook and Instagram and follow Jonathan Ball Publishers to stay updated and in the know regarding future episodes. Thanks for your interest in the story behind the story. Happy reading from everyone at PageCast.